Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 17th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he will be continuing his series on spirit-born creation. Today's session number is 3 and is titled Trees of Death and New Life. Let's listen in.
My name is Larry Rasmussen, and we're doing a series this week which has a takeoff on the Holden theme of water-washed spirit-born, and we're calling it spirit-born creation or creation-born spirit. And today we're doing the second of two sessions on trees, and today the topic is a look at trees as a religious and even ethical symbol, trees of death and trees of new life. Back of this session on trees, and then tomorrow we're going to do one on darkness, and Saturday one on water, is a theological assumption. I am assuming, along with Martin Luther and especially the traditions of Christianity that are identified as the Orthodox Communion, Russian Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox, Armenian, Syrian, etc., that, now to use Luther's phrase, the finite bears the infinite. The finite, the creaturely, carries the godly. The transcendent is immanent. That which is of God is as close to us as the breeze, the water, our skin, the presence of each other. Nature does bear divinity. Creation bears the spirit. So that's a Lutheran assumption. Lutheran had a teaching called teaching finitum capax infinity. The finite carries or bears the infinite. And that's at the heart of our understanding of Eucharist, that the bread and the wine really does bear the presence and power of God in, with, and under these elements of nature. So that's the theological assumption behind the series this week, and I'm saying that trees bear the spirit, likewise the other patterns. There's also some social and cultural analysis behind the series. One of the marks of the modern world that began 500 years ago with mercantilism and the rise of the then new economy, namely capitalism and the bourgeoisie, one of the marks of of modernity is a progressive disenchantment of the world. That phrase is one from Max Weber, a social theorist of the last century and one of the fathers of sociology. It was actually a phrase that he liked to quote from Friedrich Schiller, the German playwright, the disenchantment of the world. That is to say, modernity has seen a gradual leaking away of the sacred in the common everyday elements around us. There is a leaching of the sacred from the ordinary things of life on the one hand, and a progressive commodification of things on the other. More and more relationships to the land, relationships to all that dwells with and on the land, become moneyed relationships. That's been one of the characteristic marks of modernity. Now, the chief reason for this is that the new economy, that is capitalism, became more than a market-centered means of exchange of goods. It became a culture. It shaped a whole culture. It became a way of life. With certain key values and certain clear ways of relating to the world around us. Capitalism has been an excellent way to produce material goods on an unprecedented scale, and in fact was as able to do what feudalism and other economies before it never did, namely raise masses of people from their immiseration, really make a large middle class, another way of saying it. Capitalism has also been good for, as a culture as well as an economy, for nourishing an entrepreneurial spirit, risk-taking, achieving, a creative spirit, and working with the elements around us. But, and this is my point, capitalism has been, as a culture, has been disastrous for the soul and for the life of the spirit as these relate to the world as a sacred place. It becomes a place dominated by moneyed relationships in a culture of commodification. So land is a commodity. Chief Seattle thought you couldn't sell the air, the scent of the pine, the breeze. He doesn't know about New York. I'm from New York. You sell air rights over your buildings if you want, and you buy the scent of pine in the little bottle in the store.
Sell pollution rights now, or buy.
Yeah, you can buy pollution rights now too. So, all right, the social cultural analysis is that now we've come to a certain point. That point is that modernity is no longer sustainable as a way of life. Humanity cannot afford the modern world, and neither can the rest of nature. So this world unsustainable, and this word unsustainable enters into our vocabulary, and we will have to find ways to be part of a re-enchantment of the world, a re-beginning, a fourth human revolution beyond the agricultural, industrial, and information revolutions. And lots of interesting things are trying to happen these days that represent a next revolution. Part of that will include a conversion to Earth. I think now that all religious and moral impulses must be tested by a stringent criterion, and that stringent criterion is their contribution to Earth's well-being, to Earth's redemption, not just a human focus sense of well-being. Only a human focus sense on a commodification in a commodification culture is an unsustainable way. All right. One of the things we're to do here at Holden is to mention resources around the village that bear on these sessions. Of course, look in the tape library, but in the bookstore, many of you already know about Wendell Berry, and this is a classic. It's not new, although it has a new afterword. But if you want to pursue some of the forces that have been forces in the making of the modern world and that have now rendered it unsustainable, Wendell Berry's The Unsettling of America, Culture and Agriculture is a classic. That's in the bookstore. As of yesterday, Alan Durning's How Much Is Enough, which I put up here on the board behind me, was in the bookstore, but I think the last copy was sold out. There will be some more on order. Alan Durning isn't so much talking about how this has come to pass, but what to do about it now. What's a constructive response? How much is enough in our lives? Not the literature from the 70s and 80s about sort of lifestyle, what can each of us do. This is an effort to say, what do human beings, what is the carrying capacity of the planet, and how do we need to live so that all of us can maintain a sustainable lifestyle? And then I've tried in two different works to talk about how we got where we are and what we now need to do in response. One of them is in the bookstore as a book, Moral Fragments and Moral Community, forces going into the making of the modern world and what ought to be our response, including a chapter on what particular roles churches can play. And then my publisher says, hustle your books, even if you're... he says, hustle your books. So I have a flyer for one that's coming out in the fall called Earth Community, Earth Ethics, which is an effort to say where we go from here. And as was noted before we started, it has a convenient order form on the bottom of the sheet and is on green paper, recycled paper. Now, if we're talking about a necessary conversion to Earth and a re-enchantment of the world, that will only be found in the details. You don't do that in the abstract. It's not a matter of belief in the sense of just an idea. You have to touch it. It has to be palpable. You have to feel it. It has to be in the particulars of our lives. And it's in that connection that in this series I've been trying to revisit creatures of nature that have had in the past and still do religious and ethical meaning. And yesterday and today we're taking a look at trees. Yesterday it was the ecumenical religious symbol of the tree of life, and then how trees have been seen in some quarters as trees of resistance. That is to say, they're still trees of life, but the context is such that people are fighting the culture of death in their midst and seeing in trees something of importance to them as they do resist. So let's turn then to trees of death and trees of new life, and I'm going to share some of this with you. Spend a little bit of time talking about why trees speak to us in these terms, and I want us to have time then to discuss together your stories of trees of death and your thoughts about why it is that trees somehow have a hold on the human spirit, if the culture hasn't completely commodified them so that our own spirits only see in them lumber. Sometimes the unspeakable does happen. I mean, resistance comes too late, it's too little, and nothing but sheer terror and horror and murder prevail. That has happened from time to time. This century has been the most deadly of all of them. 187 million people have died at the hands of violence in this century. One such time, of course, was the Holocaust of 50 and 55, 60 years ago. Still, even there, trees stand for life when no human words can be formed at all. Or rather, the tree is there when the only voice heard in Rama is the voice of Rachel, who cannot be consoled because her children are no more, the voice of wailing and loud lamentation. If any of you have been to Jerusalem and have gone to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial there, you know that one of the signs of life at Yad Vashem is the Avenue of the Righteous, where a tree is planted for each Gentile who rescued a Jew, saved a Jew from the death camps. A bush or a tree is planted for each of these rescuers, and then you have this avenue then lined with them. Each of them is a tree of life from a time when life was wrenched away from 6 millions. If some of you saw Schindler's List and you stayed and sat through all of the credits at trailing the end of the film, the very last thing that's on the trailer, it says a tree was planted for Oscar Schindler in Yad Vashem. And then the last sentence is, it grows there still. There's something that speaks about life in a profound way, about trees when life otherwise can be wrenched away, or as a sign of life, even amidst death. I was also noted that at the time of the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City, when the memorial service was held, and President Clinton and Mrs. Clinton went to Oklahoma City, here's what the president said. "Yesterday, Hillary and I had the privilege to speak with some children of other federal employees, children like those who were lost here. And one little girl said something we will never forget. She said, 'We should all plant a tree in memory of the children.' So this morning, before we got on the plane to come here at the White House, we planted that tree in honor of the children of Oklahoma. It was a dogwood with its wonderful spring flower and its deep, enduring roots. It embodies the lesson of the Psalms, that the life of a good person is like a tree whose leaf does not wither." That's very touching. Not too long before that, and speaking of Israel with its agonies and the conflict between Jews and Palestinians, the White House hosted the signing of the Middle East Accords with Yitzhak Rabin, since assassinated, and Yasser Arafat. And Rabin, addressing the PLO chairman, Arafat, and the Palestinians, said this at that signing: "We have no desire for revenge. We harbor no hatred towards you. We, like you, are people, people who want to build a home, to plant a tree, to love side by side with you, to live in dignity and empathy as human beings." Well, there you have it. To love, to build a home, and to plant a tree. Those are the conditions of peace. So the tree of life, then, is anything but a stranger to suffering and death. Now, there are times, of course, when trees aren't signs of life at all, but only signs of death. The lynching tree has never been a tree of life. The gallows has never been a tree of life. I'm told that people who experience suicidal depression often see themselves in a dark wood. And I remember as a child, when I had experiencing times of fear, I imagined myself lost in the dark forest. I mean, there's something very foreboding in these images as well. So trees lining cemeteries are often quiet and sturdy signs of life, but they're also a kind of reminder of mortality there in their own quiet way. In Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is in our bookstore, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Toni Morrison, Seth flees slavery after a brutal beating. Amy, a young girl, finds her in the woods, pregnant. Amy unfastens Seth's dress to look at her wounds. And Toni Morrison writes this: "Come here, Jesus," Amy says in quiet horror at what she sees. "It's a tree, Lou, a chokecherry tree. See, here's the trunk. It's red and split wide open, full of sap. And this here's the parting for the branches. You got a mighty lot of branches. Leaves, too, looks like. And dern if these ain't blossoms. Your back got a whole tree on it, in bloom. What God have in mind, I wonder. I had me some whippings, but I don't remember nothing like this." Years later, Seth begins to cry when Paul D., her lover, was touching every ridge and rubbed his cheek on her back and learned that way her sorrow, the roots of it, its wide trunk and intricate branches. Seth couldn't feel that Paul D. was touching her, every ridge and leaf of it with her mouth, however, because her back skin had been dead for years from the whippings. So here you have a tree that, instead of a tree being associated with flourishing life, the tree instead captures flourishing pain and oppression. So trees aren't an unambiguous sign of life. They don't convey only life, and certainly not all life or life wholly redeemed. They're limited bearers of truth. They're bent carriers of guidance. They're ambiguous symbols, as all our symbols are. That's just a comment in passing, but it's an important one. There are no images of God, and images of ourselves and images of life which are unambiguous. And that's the reason why you need many, many images. All of them are ambiguous. If you choose only one image for image of God or truth as we know it, you'll end up, sure enough, in idolatry, which is why biblical images are multiple, to speak of divinity, to speak of truth, to speak of life, speak of us. All right, that said, it's another kind of testimony that trees don't seem to rest very long with the brute reality of death. They just don't stay there. We don't let them stay there. They keep struggling against death. They will not let us accept death as a final utterance and not let us see life's deformations as finally acceptable. They make every effort to claim life anew, and that's one reason why Seth, even with this tree of pain on her back in Morrison's Beloved, loved the woods. It was there in that green blessed place, I'm reading Toni Morrison now, where the woods rang, that the assembles sang to Seth's mother-in-law when she came to preach, and where Seth herself found life. If you've read Toni Morrison, you know that one of the figures in there is Baby Suggs, who gathers, preaches in the clearing. And the slaves all come to the woods around the clearing when they know that Baby Suggs is going to preach. Now, this is the days of slavery, so the church is what in the black church traditions is called the invisible church. Couldn't meet in a, build a church and meet in it. It was against the rules. So you had invisible church, usually in a secret place in the woods. And now Baby Suggs is going to preach. And the ex-slaves, in the heat of every Saturday afternoon, would come to this clearing in the woods where, on a huge flat-sided rock, Baby Suggs bowed her head and prayed silently. And then Toni Morrison writes, "The company watched her from the trees. They knew she was ready when she put her stick down. Then she shouted, 'Let the children come!' And they ran from the trees to her. 'Let your mothers hear you laugh,' she told them, and the woods rang. The adults looked on and could not help smiling. Then, 'Let the grown men come,' she shouted. They stepped out one by one from among the ringing trees. 'Let your wives and your children see you dance,' she told the men, and ground life shuddered under their feet. Finally, she called the women to her. 'Cry,' she told them, 'for the living and the dead, just cry.' And without covering their eyes, the women let loose." If you want to read the sermon and the rest of it, It's in the bookstore. All right. Yet the boldest attempt to wrest a tree of life from the tree of unspeakable death was one that rooted a new religion. They put him to death by hanging him on a tree, Peter preached to the crowds. But God raised Jesus on the third day and made him manifest, Acts 10. Maybe you've been to some of the Bible studies on Luke, Acts. Celsus, who was a second century Roman philosopher and a vehement opponent of the new religion, Christianity, ridicules second century Christians because they call this dead tree of Calvary the tree of life. That was a common way early Christians referred to the cross. They also expect, this is Celsus now, the resurrection of the flesh through the wood. And Celsus scoffs at them. He says, what drunken old woman telling stories to lull a small child to sleep would not be ashamed of muttering such preposterous things? I mean, the worst image he can think of, a drunken old woman, is the one who would be telling kids such stories. Now, Celsus knows something about what he's talking about, because the cross was an execution form that was reserved for the lowest classes and for traitors, for the seditious, by the Romans. A cynical folk saying of the day went like this: the rich buy judgment, the poor get the cross. If you got enough money, you can get a good lawyer. But if you don't, you're on death row. Romans had, in the barbarism of the wars with the Jews, actually lit roadsides with Jews whom they torched on crosses. So for Christians to call a cross, which was a form of execution outside the gates of Jerusalem, the Tree of Life, brings this kind of scoffing. So Celsus is only reflecting high society when he condescendingly says of Jesus that he had been bound in the most ignominious fashion and executed in a shameful way. He could have cited the poem of Pseudo-Manetho of the time. Punished with limbs outstretched, they see the stake as their fate. They are fastened and nailed to it in the most bitter torment, evil food for birds and grim pickings for dogs. But early Christians saw in the tree of execution the tree of life, and they called it that, just as they also saw in Jesus new life from a tree that had been given up for dead. A shoot shall come out from the stump of Jesse, and a branch will grow out of his roots. You've got a tree fully severed at the base, which still will sprout new life. And someday, the prophet dares to promise, recalling last Sunday's Eucharist and the lessons from last Sunday, the prophet promises, you will go out in joy and be led back in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall burst into song, and all the trees of the field will clap their hands. Beautiful image of trees clapping. All right, so that we've got some time for discussion, let me just say a couple of things about why trees seem to convey something of the sacred to us. Why do we reach for trees as disclosures of meaning and a way of kind of standing upright in the world? Why do they, as a form of nature, move us and help create a habitable world for the soul? What do trees do that we seem to sense in our innermost parts is a kind of reaching upward of life itself. What connects sap and blood, to remember the Mayan word, where the same word is used for sap and blood because they're both a life force? As I mentioned yesterday, civilization, it is said, begins with the felling of the first tree and it ends with the felling of the last one. In some cases, it's been literally so. There's the case that someone you did mention to me yesterday about Easter Island, talking about the felling of the last tree. You know about Easter Island and the discovery of this huge stone statues, which are much, much too heavy for any persons to have carried them to different places on Easter Island, and how it became a mystery as to how these enormous shrines and statues got to the places they did. When Europeans first visited Easter Island in the 18th century, it was already so completely devoid of trees, except for a few at the bottom of the deepest volcanic crater on the island. Pollen analysis shows that Easter Island once had extensive woods. However, it's the Pacific. It's in an area where the islands are lush. As the best evidence we have so far tells the story like this. As the population grew, the people felled more and more trees. One use was to move these enormously heavy rock statues to ceremonial sites around the island by way of a moving track made with logs. That's how they could get them there. Laying tree trunks alongside one another. Other trees were felled for more ordinary needs, plots for agriculture, fuel for cooking, heating, construction material for household goods, pole and thatch housing, canoes for fishing. By 1500, trees were scarce enough that people no longer built houses of poles, but made reed huts and moved into natural or dug caves. Reed boats soon replaced the wood canoes. This limited the fishing, however, and because the reed boats couldn't make as long a trip out into the ocean as the wood boats could. Soil erosion hastened because the hills had been denuded. The fishing waned because not only because they couldn't get as far out, but because now they had to make they couldn't make their nets from the paper mulberry tree. They had to use which they used to make cloth because they didn't have them anymore. The soil erosion as well as the heavy Pacific Ocean rains meant that the crops declined. About the only food source unaffected were chickens. And as these became more valuable to a hungry population, they literally had to be defended. So one of the things that's left on Easter Island are stone chicken coops to protect your chickens from marauding neighbors. After 1600, the islanders, without trees and canoes and with a diminishing food supply, were trapped and they fell into almost continuous warfare with one another over scarce supplies. Slavery became common, even among kin. There are even some signs in the end of cannibalism. With the environment ruined by deforestation, society collapsed. Civilization fell with the felling of the last tree. So quickly, in fact, that half of the great statues were still in the Rano Raraku quarry when the Europeans arrived. The Europeans, then, standing on a treeless island, in an otherwise lush zone of the earth, were mystified how these great carved rocks had walked around the island. Well, half of them had walked over trees while the other half no longer had any way of walking. They just slept dead in the quarry. So it seems that trees hold up not only the sky, as Native American stories of origin claim, but trees hold up civilization as well. Trees mean home and shelter for humans and other animals, tools, furniture, fishing vessels and other boats, and in fact all of the products that have been and can be made from trunks, branches, and leaves, these pages included. Trees also mean food, both directly from trees and by way of protecting watersheds and holding and nourishing the soils that grow the foods. Trees mean fuel. They remain the basic energy supply for roughly half the Earth's people. We don't think of that because we're a petroleum-based society, fossil fuel-based society. But about half of the population of the world is still dependent upon trees for firewood and heating. Trees also mean medicines, thousands of them discovered, some of them yet to be discovered. Not least, trees are the habitat for the majority of the world's species, many of them known and vital to civilization, many still unknown, potentially vital, and forests are still home to a lot of people. So trees do an enormous amount in our lives. Now, that's not the end of it. They also entertain the journey of the spirit of forest peoples and others. They're the subject of story, poetry, painting, and sculpture, the sight and substance of things religious. They're essential to both the basic needs of civilization and to its flowering, to culture. But our dependence on trees is even more profound than that. The Native Americans are right. Trees do hold up the sky. Without them, sky would not be. We wouldn't have an atmosphere that we could breathe without trees and other green plants. Every single breath that every single human being has ever taken or will ever take depends on trees and other plants. Oxygen is the work of trees and not the hospital supply room. In fact, in Earth's slow womb, trees together with other plants created the conditions that eventually made for life. The atmosphere wasn't what it is now, originally. There was very little oxygen. And it was the fact that plants eventually got to take hold that created the atmosphere that made it possible for the co-evolution of plants, air, water, and animals. And trees, by absorbing carbon dioxide and producing oxygen, link air, water, and living things together in a unity that continues to make for life. So the Native American legend is quite exactly the case, even when the language is a mythic language. Namely, the sky is held up by the trees. I'm quoting now from Native American legend. If the forest disappears, the sky, which is the roof of the world, will collapse. Nature and man then perish together. All trees are trees of life. And no civilization has a substitute. Now, the reason is utterly basic. Everybody sitting in here, whether you knew it or not, you're all heterotrophs, all right? All those green trees out there, up on the mountain behind you, are all autotrophs. Every heterotroph that ever lived is utterly dependent upon autotrophs. Why? Because autotrophs are the only creatures in all God's creation that can change inorganic matter into organic matter. They know how to feast on the sun in a way that we don't. You and I don't do photosynthesis well. And chlorophyll will have the last word, believe me. So, It is literally the case that all green plants are trees of life. And maybe we have something still deep within us that senses this dependence upon trees. Okay, I'm going to finish now. There's something here of direct moral importance. What trees do is help disclose that we're located in nature amid deep kinship and deep dependence and deep difference with others. The word that's the root word for forest is the same as the root word for foreign. That which is, meaning that which is different, that which is other. One of the tasks of our time is to learn to live with otherness and with difference in a way that we also sense is a matter of deep kinship. And maybe if we can re-enchant the world in such a way that we see that those trees are trees of life other than us, and yet we are kin with them, we'll be able to make some headway in a world in which we're going to have to learn to live with difference and otherness. That is to say, nature is in us as essential relationship. This relationship is not peripheral. Our relationship with the other constitutes our own being itself. Deeper appreciation of difference, of otherness, of forests and foreign, goes hand in hand, or hand in branch, with a sense of the underlying kinship of all things. So Isaiah was quite right. All flesh is grass. But it's grass. All flesh is literally grass. I mean, you wouldn't have any if it weren't for grass. That's how deep the dependence is. Trees are also bearers of the Spirit, and that returns us to the prophets. And I close with Isaiah 65 so that we can have some discussion. In Isaiah 65, the days of a tree gather up the prophet's dream. I mean, his vision of when earth, all of it, in the prophets, it's not human beings that are redeemed and saved only. It's all creation, the mountains and the trees, the valleys. His way of gathering in the reign of God when all things will be redeemed is in the image, the days of a tree. So I'm reading from Isaiah 65. When that day comes, no more shall there be an infant that lives but a few days, or an old person who does not live out a lifetime. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring blessed by the Lord, and their descendants as well. All right. I want to. We had a good time yesterday hearing some of people's tree stories, and I want to continue that today. Just to hear a little bit more about how trees have been partners with you in the journey of the Spirit, or what your experience with trees has been. Have you had this sense of kinship with something that is other? God, you know, in almost in most religions is often portrayed as the holy other, and holy meaning both W-H-O-L-L-Y and H-O-L-Y. Sometimes I think if human beings learned how to have a sense of deep kinship with the other, meaning non-human, like a tree, we might have a sense of how we relate to God as the holy other. Yeah.
Well, I'm a native of Western Washington, and when I was growing up, I mean, go to Mount Rainier or any of the areas that I would go to see or go up to, like the Olympics, there were all the trees on the hill. Well, I don't know if any of you realize how we almost weep every time we see so much clear cutting on these huge hills. I mean, it would be like this whole mountain is full of trees, and then there's a big cut.
What I always remember is the big cedar tree that we went up to in the Olympics. And our family, we have five children and Benny, and we surrounded holding hands, and we had to have
could you get around
more
it?
People
oh.
to do it.
Yeah.
And then there was a forest fire a few years ago, and we learned that that tree was caught in the forest fire. And it, you know, it really makes you really feel like you lost somebody, even though it was a tree, but it was something very special.
Have you been up there? Did it possibly survive? Cedar often do. Have you been there since to see if it may have survived?
Been there, yes. Yeah. I've heard people be up there. And the forest renews itself, you know, but at the rate they're cutting the trees, everybody in the country should realize that the Forest Service is letting too much go that won't be able to be replaced as soon as we need it for the next generation.
Yeah. Among all that, those forests are some of that private land, and they're doing a lot more because they can ship them off their private land directly to Japan. But I think, or the Korea and other places, I think I know of an economy that's lost its basis as forests, and that was in Sabah, north of Borneo.
Oh, yes.
And, but the I was thinking in terms of trees, of on a hike on the east side of the Olympics, and a large Douglas fir had fallen down. We were with a bunch of elementary age kids. We can't, and so they cut it so that the trail could get through. And the tree was farther across. The diameter of the tree was across, and the boy, sixth grade boy, I was hiking with. So we stopped to look at that and how big that tree was, and he was just stood in awe of that, and talk about each ring as being a year, and that the trees not only are the tree of life, but they transcend my life.
Yes.
That it's not just my generation for a tree.
That's right.
A stalk of corn is this year, or azalea maybe a few years, but transcend multiple generations.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we portray our multiple generations as family trees. But there are trees alive today that transcend anybody's family trees. You know,
Alpha Delta Kappa is an honorary sorority for women educators. Mm. And I was the state chaplain for 2 years. Mm. And they always have a funeral service for everyone that has died and belongs to the state organization. And they always had a representative come up and then gave them a carnation that was going to die within, you know, 5 minutes after they, and there was nothing to take back. And Jerusalem and Israel is near and dear to my heart. I've been there about 4 times. And so I thought, I'm going to have them plant a tree in memory of the sisters that had passed away that year. And so I had some contacts in Israel and sent some money and had that done and had blank certificates sent to me. And then I had a friend calligraphy. And so everyone that came up then had a certificate with their deceased sister's name on it and a tree was planted.
That's lovely. And that's that sense of future generations. You know that that's going to be a sign of life there for a long time. That's beautiful. Yeah.
We don't have very many maples in this part of the world, but one of the tree images that's very strong to me is my grandparents who lived in the part of the world where they did have maples. It was a large white house at the end of a long gravel walk, and with a row of maples on each side of the gravel drive. The only way you could get to the house was through those maples. Mm-hmm. And the only way you could leave was through those maples. And they were different every time you went.
Yeah.
And there would be the time when the seas would come spinning down, which was a magical thing.
Yeah, the helicopter seas.
And the last time we were there, the house had passed through several sets of hands, and the trees were all gone.
Mm.
But there was on that same trip back to Norway, I noticed another thing about maples. In the fortress that sits by the harbor in Oslo, the walls, part of the inner walls, are lined with some large old maple trees. And I remember for many years after the war, those maples were scarred in the trunks. What they were scarred from were bullet holes, because that's where people were shot in front of these maples.
Oh.
And the last time we were here, when the maples were gone from my grandparents' house, the scars were gone from those maples finally.
Our neighbors, of course, have the maple leaf as a national emblem. Yeah.
And it's interesting to note that when we're buried here, if we're buried, if we're buried inside of the tree, pine might be mahogany.
Yeah, that's right. That hadn't even occurred to me.
You're really buried in metal cap.
Earlier was in Dallas, Texas. I was traveling down there once, and they have this tree somewhere. It's always familiar. And somebody had poisoned that tree. And they had, and now, in fact, even Ross Perot, they had enlisted him with his money to spend a great amount of money to try to save the tree. They dug around all the roots underneath, dug all the dirt around, and tried to bring clean dirt in and bring it around just to save this tree, under which I guess some major treaties have been signed or something like that. One city was entirely focused on saving one.
I tell you, the New York Times, shortly before I left home, had a piece on it where one city was also focused on not just one tree, but someone had moved into Old Greenwich, Connecticut, which has a lot of beautiful trees, and this person had bought their house and had a large acreage with a lot of trees on it, and decided that he just wanted a lovely lawn out there. So he clear-cut his front yard, and the town was outraged at him. He found out how attached some people were to trees. I mean, he said, I had no idea that you couldn't cut down trees on your own property without getting everybody mad at you.
Knut and I have a cabin property over on Blewett Pass. For those of you that know, the state of Washington is down a little ways from here. And we, our property borders the Wenatchee National Forest. And so when the Forest Service decided that they were going to have a timber sale, it was on the Wenatchee National Forest right next to our property. There are many wonderful and some very sad stories and some just interesting stories that have been part of this timber sale that we participated in
with the Central Washington Audubon Society and several other groups and several other individuals. But of the many images that come to mind, we participated in this with these people over a period of over 4 years as we wrote the appeal to the Forest Service and went through the whole process and happily actually won. We had some very fine attorneys who worked with us pro bono, and we actually set some very important precedents in terms of timber sales in eastern Washington. But one I will never forget is the group of us as we were writing the appeal to the Forest Service. It was a blistering hot week in eastern Washington, just as it was to those of you who came here the first part of this week on Sunday. And I think over in the Wenatchee area, it was somewhere around 110. And we sat together. There were about 6 to 8 of us. And we divided up the appeal into different sections. Each person would write a different part of the appeal. And Knut and I had our section that we were working on. And somebody else had another one. And we sat and huddled in a tiny little house that was probably no longer than from that tree over to the corner.
We're sitting amid the trees.
Yeah, there was no fan in the ceiling. It was horribly hot, and outside were these horrid yellow jackets. And every time we would open the door to go in and out, you know, to get food or get some piece of paper or go copy something off, you know, we had to slam the door to keep the yellow jackets from coming in and out. And yet, for 4 solid days, we sat there and wrote that appeal and completed it. And I think of that often. About, we would never do this. That was crazy. And yet there was this compelling interest that we had for stopping this timber sale, which we knew never should take place, that kept us together and kept us going through this whole process.
Yeah. I think it's the trees more than anything else that makes me a Washingtonian and not simply a West Texan. Every time I return to Texas, I say, oh, where are the trees? But one of the interesting things is that trees are so important in West Texas and New Mexico that for, I guess, a century and a half, when the cowboys have their camp meetings, they always select a prayer tree.
Oh.
They gather around the tree and have prayers.
Oh, I didn't know that. In East Africa, trees will be picked out as the place for making important community decisions, and the people will gather around a specific tree, as well as prayer trees. That is to say, trees are often the site of worship too, but I had no idea that that was the case here.
Our first trip to Europe, I remember, was Pentecost Sunday when we arrived. Pfingst, I think it's called.
Yeah, it's Pfingsten, yeah, Pfingsten. In Germany. In
and
Germany,
we went
I don't
to the cathedral, this cathedral in town, and they had all these trees.
Yeah.
In the, you know, I'm used to Christmas trees in a church, but these were, I don't know what kind of, regular kind of trees.
Yeah.
Up and down the aisle in this church, and that's part of their Pentecost celebration.
That's right.
Really quite a moving experience to walk in and find all these trees in there.
Yeah.
Why do we have the trees?
It's associated with spring. I don't know why else. I mean, everyone says it's Pfingsten, it's time to go for a walk in the woods. I mean, I don't know what all the association is other than spring, and that's one reason why they're in the church. Of course, we've taken over, we don't have time to catalog all this, but into Christianity we've taken all sorts of trees and made them part of it. I mean, the Christmas tree is a pagan custom that was taken over by Christians.
To stop logging
in Oregon, a woman's collective decided to use, instead of the dangerous thing of sticking nails in the trees, and, which can really harm somebody,
yeah.
They used yarn. They called it yarning. Big balls of yarn, they go and wrap them around the trees. And if the men would come, the loggers would come and try to cut the trees, the yarn is strong enough that it would just gum up their
tree trunk. This is non-violence in action.
What they would have to do is cut the yarn, but they wouldn't bring scissors because that was an effeminate kind of tool.
Oh.
So they would cut the yarn with their Bowie knives, and they end up spending a much longer time. They eventually ended up yarning in their trucks.
Oh, yarn, no.
Wrapped them with yarn. It's just kind of a symbol of women's wisdom against the devil.
And the weapons of the weak, you know.
Well, we remember a Christmas tree in a church that had been up, and then at Easter, the tree was still there and had been cut into, the branches had been cut, so it was a cross.
Oh, yes.
And it had stayed from Christmas to Easter in that way.
Yeah.
And we had a birch tree fall down in our front yard, and what it has allowed is we now have a place where we can grow a garden.
Uh-huh.
Because the tree left, we have sunshine.
Yeah, yeah.
We have no sun.
Yeah. The image of the cross once more, maybe a good place to close. At the Canberra Assembly of the World Council of Churches in 1991, there was a plenary session for the assembly on the struggles of women throughout the world. And so the women each in turn told her story of particular issue and struggle in her home country and the presence and power of God amidst that struggle. So a Palestinian, a Russian, a Canadian, a Filipina, etc., each in turn telling a story. And at the end, each of them took a green branch and placed it in a large wooden structure at the back of the stage. And that when they had all finished their stories, they all together went over and lifted this wood structure up, and it was the cross become a tree of life. It turns out that the greening of the cross is a Armenian Orthodox tradition that's been traced back at least to the 3rd century. In which you have the greening of the cross, where the cross is the tree of life, and in the Armenian Orthodox Church to this day, the cross is a flowering cross. That's the way which it symbolizes. Okay, I'm going to close now because of time's up. But in light of this discussion, with a very sobering picture presented by Alan Durning. He has a device, an imaginary time-lapse film, and he plays time back to the Neolithic Revolution, which is about 10,000 to 8,000 BCE, at 1 millennium a minute. So you're watching a film in which time is passing 1,000 years per minute. For 7 minutes, this planet here looks like a still photograph. Forests cover 1/3 of the land. The agricultural revolution makes changes, but on a small enough scale that they're hardly visible. Agricultural revolution took place about 8 to 10,000 years ago. Then at about 7.5 minutes, the islands and the lands of the Aegean Sea began losing their force. You can read about deforestation in Plato. At 9 minutes, that is 1,000 years ago, scattered parts of Europe, Central America, China, and India show some threadbare sections at the forest
mantles. 6 seconds from the film's end, which is 1 century ago, Eastern North America shows the same. Still, there are forests over 32% of the Earth's surface a century ago. And then suddenly, in the last 3 seconds, that is since 1950, there's an explosion that occurs. Forests vanish in Japan, the Philippines, mainland Southeast Asia, Central America, the Horn of Africa, Eastern South America, Western North America, the Indian subcontinent, West and Sub-Saharan Africa, the Amazon Basin, Papua New Guinea, and Malaysia, Borneo. Central Europe's forests are there, but they're poisoned. Incursions take place in Siberia and Canada's north. In only 45 years, forests fall to 26% from 32% of the Earth's land cover. And only 12% of that is intact forest ecosystems. The rest is commercial timber. So, with Shakespeare then, Sonnet 73. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few do hang, upon these boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. I hope it doesn't come to the place where the forests are bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. Thank you.